Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. We just returned from UK Games Expo 2025, and there's some new games to add to the great library of RPGs. I've got a copy of the new Quest Worlds, the new Call of Cthulhu campaign setting, Sutra of the Pale Leaves, set in 80s Japan, and the new science fiction companion for Savage Worlds Adventure Edition. I've been reading Oliver Berkman and his Manifesto for a Life Where You Can Accept the Imperfections. He suggests that you should stop seeing your book pile as a bucket that needs to be emptied. Instead, you should see it as a river that you need to swim along, and when you're ready for a book, you reach out for it. Can that mindset help me with my gaming and all the games I want to learn and play? In this episode, we're still talking about magic. Well, sort of talking about magic. We had a complaint from one listener, Wayne Peters. When are you going to actually start talking about magic? And in this episode, it's more like an appendix, featuring the bits that awkwardly fit together and are sort of related to magic, and our inability to get round to actually talking about it. If that sounds a bit too meta, then you haven't been paying attention. In this episode, we have renowned British science fiction author Adrian Chukowski, author of the incredible Children of Time. Amongst many others, he was keen to introduce us to Ars Magica and the potential of the game to engage in magic in new and imaginative ways. He's really good at explaining the appeal and key concepts behind the game. He brings his distinctive passion for world building to play as he explains the fundamentals of the game. Ars Magica, or Ars Magica, as we sometimes refer to it as, was first created in 1987 by co-authors Jonathan Tweet and Mark Rain Hagen, and was republished in various editions. It's currently in its fifth, which is the version that I've been looking at. The definitive edition is currently in production following a crowdfunding campaign. Since I've come back to playing role-playing games back in 2010, I have been intrigued by the game and drawn towards its setting and the application of Latin to generate magical ideas. And I'd love to say that Judge Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, turns his eye to Ars Magica, but we haven't played it yet. And we don't like to talk about a game that we haven't played. Instead, we talk about how difficult it is to fit everything in. It was recorded in early May when we were filled with a sense of joie de vivre. We'd returned to our spiritual home of the Latter Gowrie pub in Manchester. The snug was available. We weren't expected to record a chat, but we did it anyway. Hopefully you'll find it interesting and entertaining. Fast forward about a month, and in the I'll Get My Coat section, we share our initial reflections on UK Games Expo 2025. We talk about some of the games we played and other experiences over the weekend. I'll be back at the end with some patron news. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open Box!
Okay, welcome to the Zoom of Role-Playing Rambling to Open Box, the part of the podcast where we look backwards to look forwards. And this time I'm joined by Arthur C. Clarke award-winning author Adrian Chukowski. Hello there, Adrian.
Hello. Hello. Lovely to be here.
Thank you very much for being on. Where are you beaming in from, Adrian?
Probably not that far away. So I'm just outside Leeds.
I always ask this question to start off with. How did you get into role-playing games? So how did you start?
So I would have been about 12. It would have been my first year of secondary school. I was already very, very into fighting fantasy books, which had been out for a few years. I remember going into a classroom at lunchtime and there were a whole bunch of people around a table and there were some maps and some miniatures and some dice. And it was the maddest thing because basically anyone who wanted to bring a character in could just be part of the game, dropping. Yeah, there was no continuity. There was no sense of story or anything like that. It was just, I suspect that you got one rolling encounter of which you got maybe two combat turns per lunchtime that just ran throughout the course of an entire term. But once I discovered this existed, I went absolutely mad for it. It very much became my thing. So this was start off with basic D&D and then moved to advanced D&D fairly early on. And I listened to your episode with Charlie Mayville and a lot of the things he said about the reason he made that switch were very much the same with me, but especially the idea that you could be an elf or you could be a fighter, but you couldn't be an elf who was a fighter. There was just the idea that all elves were this, which just sort of rankled with the particular sort of neurodiversity of my brain. And then I basically have never stopped playing really since then. And obviously, you know, I've diversified a lot in games, but you know, I'm still playing fifth ed of that same game and a variety of other games since. But that was it very much. It was my key hobby. It was the thing that kept me sane because myself and a couple of other people were basically our gaming group and we just stuck together and that was what we did. And we didn't, you know, the thing we had at school to keep us just sort of sound and healthy. Because none of us, frankly, had a particularly good time at school, which is obviously a fairly common thing for people who are gaming back in the 80s.
Have you kept a continuity with people that you play with?
Or... Yeah, so the people I was playing with in secondary school, I am still playing a Wednesday evening game with.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and obviously it's kind of come and gone. Where there before 2020, we were maybe playing like two or three times a year at most. And then for the obvious reasons in 2020, we discovered that actually, yes, you can play online. And that's absolutely revived our gaming. So we now play like 2 out of 3 weeks at least.
And D&D still got a centrality to your playing, does it?
I mean, I'm playing three games at the moment, or I'm running one. And I'll say that I'm running two games technically and playing two games. This is sounding absolutely insane. But one of which is I'm playing in is D&D, and there's always kind of been a D&D game ongoing. But there's, you know, obviously the role playing landscape is enormously diverse these days. So there's a lot of other stuff I've sort of played and run over the years.
You're known for being a science fiction author. And how has that? I'm always curious about how writing in this genre and participating in role playing games, how does that inform each other?
I mean, it's no exaggeration to say I wouldn't be a writer unless I was a gamer. The way it happened was I came across the Dragonlance books. Back in the, well, whenever they, I cannot even remember now whenever they came out, but that was, they're obviously a write-up of someone's D&D campaign. That was just this light bulb moment of, all right, that's actually something I could do. That's, you know, I could take the gaming that I do and turn it into writing. Without that, I think I'd never have got to the point of thinking, yes, I could write a book. But the other thing that you get specifically from gaming is, especially if you're a games master, creating worlds for games and creating characters for games, these are eminently transferable skills to writing. And I still, you know, when I'm writing a book, I will always start by making the world. You learn to make robust worlds when you're games mastering because you don't know where the players are going to go. And therefore, you learn to make a world that is considerably bigger than the individual story, your scenario, or your book is trying to tell. And I think that gives a real sense of immersion, which that is one of the key reasons people go to fantasy and science fiction. I think the other thing you get from gaming is if you are a games master and you're preparing things for your players, you have an audience in mind. You have a readership. You have people who are going to be reacting. So you can design things specifically to get responses out of your audience. And that is an enormously useful way to approach writing, I think.
And this might be me reading too much into it, but thematically, you tend to have societies with organizational structures and the interplay of those with the characters. Do you think that is that been an influence as well, the idea of a game structure?
A lot of, that's how most sort of, if you have societies, you have structures and you have hierarchies and so forth. And one of the big themes in my writing is the interplay and abuse of power. Of all things, I'm not sure that one does come out of games necessarily, because obviously if you look at your kind of classic Dungeons and Dragons experience, that doesn't really exist. You are kind of just inserting the party into a dungeon like a wedge, and they just sort of rampage through it, taking stuff and killing stuff. And there isn't really necessarily in that base experience any kind of structure per se. I think that tends to come later. And I guess it starts to become a core part of games like Vampire, where the vampire politics are an inherent element of the game. But I don't think that was necessarily something I'm bringing from the gaming side of things.
Definitely the world building aspect, because I suppose that's your kind of signature, isn't it? The creation of cultures and immersive alien worlds.
Yeah, and I think it's, right from the beginning, I was most fascinated by monster manuals and things like that. And obviously in D&D, you've got this enormous profusion of sort of sapient sort of humanoid races, and a lot of, rather more than are necessary. And you can look back now and think, well, actually, a lot of these were just kind of made as one-trick ponies for this scenario and then ended up in the book. And you end up with this enormously overpopulated world. But at the time, obviously, you start to think, well, all right, how do all these things interact? What does an orc think of a goblin? What does the hobgoblin think of a zvart? I think a zvart is a thing. how do they all? And you sometimes the books kind of gave that to you, and sometimes the books give you nothing, but you can then start to construct your own world and say, well, I'll have this weird thing from the Fiend Folio and so forth, and that will then, I will then get to decide how that relates to all of the other things, and what, what do they hate and what do they like. And that kind of structure, when you're populating your world, I think it innately leads to that sort of emergent complexity of, interesting little sort of habits and traditions and things that, basically just you're making the place as rich as possible, so wherever your players go, there's something interesting for them to find.
Yeah, and I think that's what always appealed to me, this idea of the ecology of monsters and how they exist in the world, and that thing of communicating with each other.
Yeah, because obviously, again, the traditional dungeon model is they're all just sort of sitting in their room and all the players turn up and prod them with a stick. But once you start thinking around, they've got to be doing something. Why are they down there? Why are these guys next to those guys? How do they get on? Do they fight all the time? In doing that and in thinking through it, you're making a much more interesting world for the players to encounter. So, it's rather than having there are two sequential groups of monsters and you fight one and then you fight the other, and maybe those monsters are fighting. And then what do you, maybe the players can take a side. Maybe they can kind of do the whole Yojimbo thing and wipe them both out by pretending to be on both sides. And, it just makes for a more interesting experience.
I didn't play in the 90s and you carried on. And one of the things that struck me about that period of time is, as you say, things like Vampire and other games having a structure behind them. There's a factional elements of societies that comes into play. And I want to talk to you about Ars Magica, because that is part of that world, isn't it? The factionalized world.
Yes, it is. Both in the sense of you are part of it was possibly one of the earliest games where you were part of a distinct organization, in that you're all of your characters are magi of the Order of Hermes. And that's just a given of the setting. But also, because you're part of medieval Europe, you have then got all of the real baggage of that with, you've got the feudal system, you've got your nobility, you've got the church, and then you've got sort of supernatural hierarchies as well, because you've got fairy courts and demons and actual God. It's one of the few games where actual God exists. They don't quite stat him up, but the actual, the presence of divinity has a very definite sort of mechanical effect in the game and things like that. So you're very much part of this enormous structure that theoretically goes from God all the way down to hell, and you're somewhere in the middle as a magus. Your own particular standing in all of these different sort of hierarchies and hegemonies.
So this world is very appealing to me. and I want to learn how to play it. But help me, Adrian, because I know that this is a game that means a lot to you. So how do I start and what do I do in this world?
Okay, so it is, again, as a very early example, it's a very sandbox world. The key thing is, so your main character, we'll get on to troop play in a second, your main character is going to be a magus. Your magus belongs to this Order of Hermes, which has been going for a few hundred years. It is basically a bunch of wizards that got together for mutual support and protection. They're split into 12 houses, so there you have, it's not just like everyone is the same sort of wizard. There are all these different things. There's a group that shape-changed into animals. They're the group that specializes in setting things on fire. There's one that's sort of to do with the fairy realm, that kind of thing. You will be a member of what's called the Covenant, which is a group of a physical group of mages from a variety of houses who are living together in one place, and they have servants and companions and staff and so forth. And what you do usually depends on who your current problem is. So you might have a problem with the mundane authorities. There might be a local lord and so forth who is going to cause you problems. Although as you are an actual wizard, those problems may be quite limited. You might have a nearby forest, which is full of lovely magical things that you can harvest, except it's also full of fairies who don't want you to. So you have to deal with that. There might be devils. Devils are a serious problem. There are a fairly small set of limits on magic, just to give you an example of how the logic of the game works. But one of the limits is you cannot use magic to alter anything's true nature. And that turns into you cannot use magic to tell a devil's falsehood, because falsehood is the true nature of the devil. So it's this very, very empirical, I don't know if empirical is quite the word, but the logic is followed through pretty much at every level. So there might be a devil, and you might vaguely work out there is one because you work out there is an infernal taint to some part of the area that your covenant is in. But tracking down who the devil is and what their mischief is may be enormously difficult, but also very important, because what you don't want to do is be corrupted by the infernal. The game takes place, it's a longitudinal game, so it will take place over seasons and years and indeed decades. You will quite possibly go through a century or so of European history in whatever part of Europe you decided to set up shop. Your companions will die of old age. You as Magi may not, because you can make longevity potions. You can also do all manner of other things. It's got this incredibly, it's got this incredibly simple system that lends itself to basically anything. So it's a dice roll plus a bunch of numbers against a target number. And you can do that if you're fighting someone with a sword. You can do that if you're casting a spell. You can do that over the winter when you are making potions or enchanting magic items or getting a familiar or writing new spells or learning new spells. Essentially, it's a game with a very big downtime section, so that you will do all manner of stuff off stage. And sometimes, you know, it's probably also one of the few games when you will get a setup where you're like, right, we need to go on an adventure to deal with this thing. And half the player character will say, I do not want to go on the adventure. I am working in the lab making a spell. And so it's frequently the least lucky wizards that get to actually do the adventuring. Everyone else sits at home and plays politics and does magic stuff. The way that works is you have a troop, what's called a troop play setup. So everyone has a wizard. And you will also have a companion who is kind of like a better sort of non-wizard. So you might have a troubadour who has magic enchanting fairy music, or you might have a knight who has a whole bunch of good armor and tanky combat skills. And then also there is this sort of numberless rabble of soldiers that the Covenant has access to, and you can also play one of those. So let us say you are going on the quest to go and fight the demon. You might have a couple of the wizards go, and the other three players bring their companions, and then you've got a bunch of soldiers that you can just dip into as you need. And the soldiers are going to die, probably, because that's what happens to soldiers. And the companions hopefully won't, and the magi probably won't, because if nothing else, they are fairly resistant to things like infernal magic and things and stuff like that. The joy of it really is that you can do so much. The GM can set up all manner of stuff, and you can engage with it or not engage with it as you prefer. If you want to be a lab wizard making stuff, the game provides for that. If you want to be a wizard that goes out and does politics, the game provides for that. There are rules for wizard duels. effectively, there is a whole wizard legal system you can get involved in where you can bring complaints to the Order of Hermes about other covenants who have been stealing your magic stuff and that kind of thing. You can go on the Crusades, should you wish. You can get excommunicated by the Pope. One of the other things is it's set in Europe, but it's a Europe where basically everything people may have believed is true. Definitively true. God is definitively there. Devils are definitively there and evil. My favorite example of this is the idea that if you can, I mean, you know, the idea of true names, the idea if you could speak in the language of Adam, who named everything, then it would give you enormous magical powers. How do you learn the magic of Adam? Then the game just gives you three whole possible ways of doing it that fit with kind of medieval logic. So you could do the modern linguistic thing of learn all the languages, literally all the languages in the world, and then reverse engineer the language of Eden. Or you could physically go to Eden, because Eden is full of animals that still speak that language, but you do have to fight an angel to get there. Or you can find Cain, because Cain is actually still around, and he knows the language, because that's the language he used to speak. And if you can get hold of him and kind of convince him to teach you, then that works. But also God is very down on people getting interfering with Cain. And so it's just this, the idea that you just run this medieval logic to its absolute, almost absurd extremes of how the world works. And all of it is true. And it's completely mad.
The way that you presented it does sound appealing. And it is that idea, we've been talking about magic, and this concept, this idea that if magic exists in the world, then it will inevitably have repercussions upon the world and the world, that the way that the world behaves and the way that people behave. And I think that's what you're indicating here, isn't it? That medieval history is distorted by the presence of magic.
Yes, but your magic fits within this general idea of, you know, there is God and there is the devil. There are realms. There are the fairies, and there is magical things like dragons and things like that. And then there is the divine and the infernal. It's all kind of, and in the middle is just the mundane world.
What I find surprising about looking at the rule book is that the spell lists are quite prescriptive, aren't they? The spells are determined. Much looser.
But it is. The spells you've got in the rulebook are examples only. This is the thing, I've completely failed to mention the best thing about the game in a way, because this is the best game to play a wizard in. You have a set of magical arts that basically come in the form of 5 verbs and 10 nouns, Latin ones, but so you've got, what is it, create, investigate, change, destroy, and control. And those are your 5 verbs. And then the nouns are things like, you know, animal, water, fire, mind, body, that kind of thing. Every spell is a combination of a verb and a noun. And then it has a power level depending on how much you're trying to do with it. You can learn a certain, you know, you start off with a bunch of spells as your wizard that you have learned, and you can cast those pretty reliably pretty much anytime you want. But they are quite prescriptive. You know, you will cast a fireball and it will do this and do this and do this. But if you spend 3 seasons in the lab, you can make a different spell that, that will go further or have a bigger explosion or will basically do pretty much anything else you want, as long as you're good enough in that combination of arts. You can make a spell. Alternatively, if you're caught sort of in the field, you can do spontaneous magic, which gives you much less powerful results, but you can literally do any spell you want within that. So if you're very good at creating fire, you can just do any kind of fire creation stuff on the fly without needing a spell in your grimoire, per se. So it's genuinely got the most flexible magic system of any game, because that's the game's focus. I mean, you tend to, with a lot of games where a wizard is just like one of many things you can be, wizards tend to get stiffed, because you, I mean, you know, if you think about the traditional D&D wizard, you can generally, you know, if anyone hits you with a stick, you fall over at low levels and you have like three spells and then you use just three spells and those were your spells. And now you've basically just got to hide at the back and keep whining about having a long rest. With Ars Magica, first of all, you can just do spells on the fly. And secondly, you can just spend a couple of seasons and invent a new spell to do literally whatever you can do within your the level of power of those two arts.
I've been told to start at a grog level or the companion level and then work up. Is that something that you would advise?
I don't think so, actually. Because I think you're missing most of the game at that point. I think it's still that very interesting world, but you're playing a relatively lackluster part of it. I genuinely would go in with a wizard level character. I mean, I'm tooling up for a campaign of this to start in the next couple of months. And the way I've done it is you have a bunch of very junior wizards. So you're only starting, you're just out of apprenticeship. You've got the basic wizard stuff for a character of about age, say, 25. So you're not terribly powerful and you're being sent to reclaim a lost covenant where it's gone dark. It's no one knows quite what happened to the other wizards. You're all apprentices, ergo relatively expendable. You get sent to take it over. And if you take it over and you can keep it, then it's yours. And suddenly you've got that kind of wizardly status because you've got that covenant and its votes. But I genuinely think the magic is such an innate part of the game and such a good part of the game that you'd be missing out on a lot by starting off as a grog or companion.
Right, okay. I've looked at the 5th edition, and the thing that I have bounced off is this universal mechanic. Now, I've only seen it in theory, I've not seen it in play. It's a D10, isn't it? And it behaves differently on the first roll compared to subsequent rolls, and if you roll a 1, you have to keep multiplying it. Does that work? Is that effective?
It does. I mean, I've got... It's, so effectively, yes, if you roll a 1... Then I'm just trying to remember how that, because I need to bone up on this for when I actually run it. If you roll a 1, I think you then roll again and double it.
Yes.
And then add on all of your bits.
Yeah.
So that's effectively your critical. And then if you keep rolling a 1, you can double and double, you can get truly outlandish results. I'm going to say, and this is probably makes me an Ars Magica heretic, I'm not sure as a mechanic it's necessary.
Oh, well, okay.
I think that you can probably just get a, by with rolling the dice, adding your adds, that I think is mostly there to counteract. If you roll a 0, it's a fumble, and there are quite a lot of mechanics and sort of magical things that work off fumbles. So it's there to balance out, to give you a chance of getting a really good result as well as getting a really bad result.
Yeah,
but it's one of those. It is a faintly clunky thing. Anything where people are telling you to double things or halve things or do that kind of math gets a bit fiddly. And I think that is a product of when the game was created, really. A lot of the time, I think even when you got much later editions of games that came out in the 80s and 90s, you can get these rather involved mechanics. And this is by no means as complicated as, it's like in the Chaosium system, you've got two times and five times and fifths and halves and that kind of thing. And I mean, I recently finished up running a campaign of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And I kid you not, we were just dropping rules throughout the campaign. As we just went, it's just far too complicated to keep doing this or to keep doing that or to have a special separate rule for how shields work or that kind of thing. So we ended up just having an almost kind of Darwinian slimming down of the rule set as we went through the game. So it's not uncommon, I think, with games that have been brought forward from that kind of time period. But I think it's probably a lot simpler than most of them because that is kind of as much as you get.
Yeah.
It's just really that ones and zeros on the D10 mechanic.
I quite like this idea that you mentioned that actually this could be a campaign through time. So your actual objective could be a couple of decades ahead, couldn't it? So you are your end game could be some point in the future.
Yeah. And you get this. I mean, there aren't many games that do this sort of long term. Pendragon, which is from about the same time, is another one where the idea is, you know, you play through the whole life of your knight, and then you play the son that you've had and that kind of thing. And you go through, you know, like two or three generations throughout the full Arthurian story. But the idea of just being effectively this wizard getting older and older and more powerful and more kind of, there's a thing called Wizard's Twilight. You, rather than getting old, you just kind of accumulate this. It's almost like chaos energy. So you just get weirder and weirder magic stuff going on around you. And then eventually you just vanish. And you're definitely not dead. And again, empirically, they know this because no one can contact your ghost, which is, of course, a thing you can do. But you've gone somewhere and no one is entirely sure where wizards go in their final twilight. But that could be like 300 years from when your game actually started. And you could be, you know, you could have just lived through the entirety of the Wars of the Roses, for example.
That's fantastic. So if I was going to run a game next week, what would be your starting point for me then?
Okay. I mean, definitely, I've done it a few times. And the idea of set up a covenant which had some wizards in it and they have gone and something weird has happened to them. Your players are coming in. They need to reclaim this covenant from whatever sort of thing, fairies, monsters, whatever, they are currently squatting in it, reclaim it for the Order of Hermes. And then they need to work out what's gone on with the wizards, because there is a threat out there that got rid of a bunch of much tougher wizards than they are, and they need to work out what it is. And, you know, you set a clock. It's all right. In X number of years, this thing is going to come back, and they need to be kind of ready for it by then. And at the same time, there's probably going to be another covenant nearby, which is a bit of a rival, and they've come in and they've nicked some of the books while the covenant's been empty, and so you've got to go and try and get those back. And you'll have a local lord, and how do you get on with them? And there'll probably be an abbey and various other institutions that give you almost like the light belief in the game of, all right, let's go and deal with the abbot or the lord, because that's not going to be the same as dealing with the fairies. You know, there is a limit to how bad it can go. And also, you know, some wizards and some companions are going to be, you know, that's also potentially a thing. Let's do just a session with just companions where we go and do completely mundane things and go to the village and get involved in the fair and that kind of thing.
Oh, it sounds good. And I can tell that it's your everything game, because they portrayed it with such enthusiasm.
Yeah, the one drawback is, and the reason I am not playing it at the moment, and I'm only just winding up to start it again after probably a couple of decades not playing it, is you can't do it casually. You cannot do an Ars Magica one shot. It is a game that cries out for a fairly seriously invested campaign.
Yeah, I'm going to have to clear the schedule to have a look at it. And obviously, you've got your day job as well, writing. So what are you working on at the moment?
I mean, the stuff I'm working on at the moment is, yeah, isn't going to see the light of day for at least a couple of years. I'm working on a very weird sort of sci-fi gothic horror involving a monastery full of clones on a distant exoplanet.
And have you got some releases coming up?
Yeah, so I've just had a book called Shroud out, which is, from the point of view of the human protagonists, a sort of terrifying alien survival horror. And from the point of view of the aliens, it's a jolly first contact romp.
Yeah.
Later on the year, I've got Beast Speaker, which is the third book in my Dogs of War series. And I've got a standalone novella called The Hungry Gods, which is about what happens when the billionaires come back from space to ruin Earth again. Feels very topical.
Yeah, you mention of horror. I mean, that's where I've heard you previously with good friends of Jackson Elias. Mm. So I guess Cthulhu is part of your role-playing repertoire as well, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, that was one of the first non-D&D games we picked up. And I mean, my memories of that are mostly are just a chain of dead characters, because I could not keep anyone alive in Call of Cthulhu, and frequently dying to very mundane things like, oh, it's cave-in or falling off a mountain. I just didn't even need monsters particularly just to do it. But yes, that was, I mean, and again, it was what fascinated me there was the monsters and how the, and I'm still in that line of things, I'm still much more interested in the more science fictional stuff, like, you know, the Elder Things and the Shoggoths and the Mego, and that idea, the idea that there are all these, not the godlike things like Cthulhu itself, but all of the little ones that are kind of still, that just have their own agendas and are working in the world, and that you can kind of, you can clash with, but you can also kind of potentially make deals with as well.
Mm.
I mean, who wouldn't want to be a brain in a jar being flown off to Pluto?
Exactly. Well, thank you very much for that, Adrian. It was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chatting at the lass.
Welcome to the Zoom of role playing rambling. It's the room of role playing rambling.
We're in the snug of role playing rambling.
Yeah, we're in the Lasagove. And we just thought we'd have an impromptu recording.
It's a great day because it's really sunny. And really, it's the warmest day of the year so far, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the best thing about, you know what the best thing about that is? Everyone's sat outside. So we're in here. Nobody here. It's great. Yeah.
And we're celebrating birthdays. We're also celebrating the fact that there's no election.
There's no election. There are in some parts of the country, but not in Bolton. Thank God.
So, yeah.
And unusual. I could get up at a reasonable time this morning and I'm in the pub.
So it went all round.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're in the last go. It's been a while since we've recorded in here. And we're recording on your phone, which is a bit of a change.
Yeah, you can blame me for the quality.
Yeah.
It's lack of quality. It's just yours is in the cupboard being charged, isn't it?
Yeah.
The lovely Rosie. You said you mentioned it, Rosie.
Yeah, Rosie.
That's her real name. Sounds like a barmaid made up, isn't it? And it's not. She's called Rosie.
Next NPC.
Barmaid.
Barback is going to be.
Barmaid. That is barmaid derogatory these days. I don't know, possibly.
Bar operative.
Bar operative. Rosie the bar operative. Put your phone in a cupboard.
To charge.
To charge. You'll never see it again. You'll never see her again. She didn't. I bet when we go back in there, she doesn't work behind the bar and your phone's gone. you'll be on Rip Off Britain being interviewed by
Don What's Name.
Gloria Unified or something.
Well, if I do need a replacement phone, I'm going to get one of yours, a Samsung. It's an iPhone heartbreaker. That's what they call it.
Is that what they call it? Yeah. I don't know what that means.
And I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means either.
I've heard it said about D&D, OSE games. Some people say it's like a D&D heartbreaker or something.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what it means, though. I never managed to work it out. What do you mean?
So having an impromptu chat, I thought what we could talk about is new games.
Okay.
New games.
Yep.
At the moment, I've got a bit of a schedule with my film watching, okay?
Yeah.
It's one of these convoluted ones. We'll get to the games eventually. You'll have to bear with me. I'll take you on a journey.
Okay.
To the point I want to make.
Yeah.
As you know, it can be get quite laboured, this, but... So I've made a list of films because I've realised that, you know, you get to that point, don't you, where of an evening you're thinking, right, what should I watch? And there's such a plethora of choice that you end up watching...
Gogglebox again.
Gogglebox. Or for me, like power watching Bargain Hunt, the last 10, the last 10 minutes, because... I find the bit where...
The rest of it's rubbish. There's no point.
There's no point.
The last 10 minutes, it counts.
Yeah,
it matter,
when they have the auction.
Yeah.
I take it to the point of the auction. Mm, yeah. They find some old tat.
Yeah.
And...
I'm not interested in how they find the old tat. I'm just interested in laughing at the old tat they bought. And thinking,
who's paying 70 quid for that?
40 quid for that lamp stand. And then it sells for like $17.99. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, you idiots.
Yeah.
And Gogglebox is a similar thing where you get halfway through Gogglebox and realise you've seen it before.
Yes.
Yeah. They're quite down on you at first because they're all the same, aren't they? They're all the same. They're not the same, obviously, but they feel the same. You get halfway through and think, I've seen this one.
So I got to the end of last year, 2024, and Sight and Sound, which I subscribe to.
Well done.
But it's frequently, when I read it, it's getting increasingly as though I'm reading more about films than I'm watching them because when it comes to actually watching them, I'm just not finding... I say I don't have the time because I can't fit it in with all the Bargain Hunt and doom scrolling that I'm doing. So what I decided this year was the top 50 films of 2024, going to watch them, and we've scheduled it in. and we're making a point of going through the list and watching. And it's very gratifying, and it means that you're actually watching films. But what I realised is that if you just let yourself drift, you just end up like filling the time with rubbish. And I think it's the same with games. I've been at the point where there's no theme or rhyme or reason to the games that I'm playing at the moment. Therefore, when it comes up to like a convention game that's being planned in another, 3 months and saying, what are you going to run? I'm at a loss to what to actually run because I feel a bit adrift and I want to sharpen it up and get a bit more thematic in my games.
Well, yeah, that's true, isn't it? Because you went through your post-apocalyptic theme, didn't you?
Yeah.
A while ago, which gives you a theme. But yeah, I know what you mean. You're kind of hopping from one game to another and thinking...
Well, last year, it was dominated by the fact that, I'm going to bring back Racklash, the game we played at Postal Game. And everything I did to kind of fitted around that.
Yeah.
I realised that I probably need that artificial sense of objective.
I mean, it's interesting you should say that, because I had the kind of opposite experience, really. Yeah. I've done the opposite this year. I've kind of focused on particular games. So, like, I've rediscovered Mutant Year Zero, which I think I've talked about before, but I've kind of stuck with it. So I'm running some for Marpcom, maybe running some at X-Men, depending, and I'm running some at Alba, and I've kind of stuck with Mutant Year Zero, thinking, and I ran some at Virtual Grogmeets.
Yeah.
I've kind of stuck with it, and I have to say, there is certain reward in that, actually.
Yeah.
There is certain reward in it, because you can kind of immerse yourself in the game and learn it and read it and read different aspects of it. Whereas, suppose when you just kind of go in there, touch base with it, you don't really get the full experience, do you?
No, but isn't that the thing? And that's what I wanted to get to. It all feels slightly dissatisfactory because you've got games that you haven't played. You've got games that you want to play, but know that you haven't got sufficient time in order to do as you're saying, to get the value from them.
Yeah,
because once you've made that decision, right, I'm going to make sure that for the next run, for the next 10 weeks or whatever, and focus on that, it excludes all the other stuff.
Yes, yes. And I think as well, what you find, and again, with Mutant Year Zero, looking at that, I am running some one-shots, but I'm not quite playing it fully, because when you read it, there's all these things about your arc, some of the NPCs in your arc, your relationship to them, relationship to this, and exploring this and doing that. There's quite a lot going on. And that's not unique to that game. Most games have a lot of that kind of stuff in them, don't they? They have a lot of like commitment. So we're playing Fall of Delta Green, aren't we?
Yeah.
Been in your campaign and that. We started that. And that feels like something that is quite a bit of commitment in terms of your character.
Yeah.
As you say, there is that problem of, how do you fit it all in and give it due attention to make it feel like you're really doing the game justice?
Yeah.
I think that's the key to it. It's doing the game. A lot of these games require a kind of commitment level in terms of playing them over a long term. And it's that sense of how do you feel you're doing it justice?
Yeah.
By just hopping in and hopping out every now and again.
I think there's a saying that I've seen that says that people buy books because they believe they're buying the time to read them. And I feel similar with games that when you're getting them, and I think we made this point before, you're not just getting to get, it's not just the cost of it, the monetary cost of it. What you're putting on it is the overhead of time. And that it's going to take.
I think that's a very good observation, because I think that's true with games. I buy games, or have in the past bought games and thought, I'm also not thought, it's an unconscious thing, isn't it? But I've thought, by buying this game, I'm also buying the time to run it.
Yeah.
And I will run it.
Yeah.
And it's like, we've had this discussion, it's like Dragon Bane, isn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't bought Dragon Bane. Yeah. I want to buy Dragon Bane because it's my kind of game, isn't it?
Yes.
It's my kind of game. I've not played it, but looking at it and what I've read about it, I think, surefire thing, that's my kind of game. But I'm also aware that I've got time to run it or fit it in. And also, if I did, something else would have to get kicked aside. I'd get very excited about that, because I'd get very excited about some imagined time in the future where I'm running it.
Yeah.
But to do that, something else has got to go, hasn't it? Something else has got to be kicked into the long grass.
Yeah.
And that is it's just kind of a problem with the hobby, you could say, because a lot of games, there's really good games out there, but they all require time and also a degree of commitment to fully experience them.
Yes.
Properly, in the fullest sense of the word.
And I think around the podcast, or some of, we had an impromptu production meeting, didn't we, last week? And we kind of thought, right, well, let's look ahead. What are the episodes that we've got in the future? And in the past, that has kind of determined what I'm playing in the future.
Yeah.
Because obviously, in order to talk about it, we make sure we play it. But that's becoming increasingly more difficult. So we've had a bit of a theme, haven't we, over recent months about Magic, and we've been looking at stuff that we've already played. But I've picked up Ars Magica, 5th edition, and tried to work it out. So there's that cost, isn't there, of trying to work out how the game works.
Yeah.
Not just mechanics.
That's commitment in itself, isn't it, I suppose, to work it out.
Yeah. Then to work out, right, so what do I want to do with it? So there's some published adventures. I could turn to those. Or do I, where do I start with it? And you go through that process. So every new game that you get, or a new campaign even, you have to go through that, don't you? Try and think, how does this work and how do I want it to work for me? And the realization for some of these games, particularly as Magica, is that it's going to take a while for us just to get started with it.
Yeah.
It's not
that's the thing. That's what I'm kind of saying, that there is a lot of games have a big commitment attached to them, to play them as they're meant to be played. And it's almost like they've got that big commitment attached to them. And it's at the expense of other games.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you can't play all these things properly. You can't play all these things fully. So it's like our experience playing DCC Lankbar on Wednesday night. We've done a bit of that. And I was pleased. I was really pleased that I got a chance to run 6, 7, 8 sessions of it for us. Because I've wanted to run that for a long time. Well, that's a setting where I've run a few one-shots in Lankbar. But it's not quite the same, because part of that setting is the background, the carousing table, some of the NPCs, the Thieves Guild, your relationships with the Thieves Guild. Whereas that Wednesday night route, we built up a kind of little campaign of interaction. You know, your character ended up owing money to somebody who was chased by debt collectors.
Yeah.
Those kind of things. And it was good. It was great to do it. But it's an example of, you can run a one-shot for DCC Lankmar. It's good, but it'll feel like a fantasy one-shot. Was if you run 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 sessions of it, it'll feel like a living, breathing city. It'll feel a bit more like Lankmar. But if you do that, you can't do all the stuff, can you?
No. And something like Ars Magica, there are other games like it. I'm going to avoid the obvious topic of Glorantha, so let's pull that towards that, because we get letters. But things like Vampyre and Ars Magica, where you kind of think, well, you know, what did he used to say about Othello, of that game? A minute to learn, a lifetime to master.
That had in the 80s.
But it has that gravitas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It has that sense where if you pick up this game, you're going to have to give it that attention. Because
a fair proportion of your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is built in there that, you know, as Adrian's describing, you might play Magi who have plans to alter things in several decades, because they're working on that scale.
Yeah.
They're working on the scale where they're so powerful, they need to make minute changes along the way of the political powers to achieve something in another 10 years' time, because for them, they're eternal. But how do you play through that? How do you do something of that scope and scale?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. If you do it as a one-shot and you're not experiencing that, you're not. So it's like that. You could say, right, we've got 8 sessions, we've got 8 RPG sessions on a Wednesday night. We could play 8 games. We could play 8 different games, couldn't we?
Yeah.
But I would say in most cases, there might be exceptions, but in most cases, if you play 8 different games, you're not really at all experiencing those 8 games in the way they're intended. Whereas if you played one game over 8 sessions, you're getting close to experiencing it as it's intended.
Yeah,
Bass. But that means the other seven games are being kicked somewhere. They're not playing that. And it's that deciding, isn't it? And like you said when you started this conversation, getting some kind of focus and thinking, well, there are all these games. They all require a degree of commitment. But what do I want to, which do I want to run and play?
Yes.
What do I want to run and play?
That's precisely
the crucial thing, isn't it? Crucial decision is have to make.
If we were running a toxic productivity YouTube channel, right? Have you never seen these?
Never seen one.
No.
Of course I'm not.
So these are the people who are telling you to live better lives.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Throw away your phone.
Shred all your jeans and just have one pair.
Have a performative notebooks where you're making a note so that people can see.
Stop wearing hats.
Yeah.
Start wearing hats. Yeah, that kind of
thing. Do a journal.
Yeah.
What we're saying here, like a toxic productivity guru, is you're going to be a bit more mindful about what you're playing and thinking ahead.
Yeah.
To think, right, what is precisely that? What do I want to get out of it? Where does this fit in with what I'm trying to get out of it?
Yeah. And also, it's very easy. It's easy to say that, but it's also very, very easy. This comes back to my Dragon Bane point. It's very easy to think, right, this year I will be running lots of this game and I will run it with one shots and I will run a little campaign. Oh, look, a new game. Oh, what's this? Oh, no, I quite like this. I think I'll run that.
Yeah.
And then a few months later, a new game. Oh, I'll run that instead and be completely sidetracked.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with Dragon Bane. I know if I get it, I will be sidetracked. I will. Because I'm not getting it.
Yeah. But if you did get it, it would be to say, right, okay.
I'm not.
Yeah, but if you did.
But I'm not.
But it could be a future topic of the podcast, couldn't it?
Don't make me buy it.
And you could say, well, for it to be a topic for the podcast, in, say, September, I'm not planting this in your head, Ernie.
It's my birthday next week. Stop it. It's a flash point now. My birthday. I'm buying. That's what I'm going to buy.
I think there's going to be a vacant slot, at least on a Wednesday, isn't it? Soon, coming up. They could probably fit it in and we could get enough games in before September.
Don't make me do that.
But that's
will do it. But that is the thing, isn't it? That's the problem.
I have been at sea over the last few months. I have been enjoying my gaming, but it hasn't felt like it's, to use that phrase, it doesn't feel like it's been mindful. It feels like it's just been something that I've been doing.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like an accelerated version of Bargain Hunt. I'm just enjoying the hits. When things go high.
The difficulty is there's so many good games out there. That's it's not like Ars Magica or Dragon Bane or whatever else you care to mention. They're rubbish. That's it'd be better if they were. If they were all rubbish. If they're rubbish and you'd think, oh, these are rubbish. There's only a few good games, you know. These are all rubbish. Or similarly, like when we were kids, they just couldn't afford it. They didn't have this problem when we were 14. Just couldn't afford it. We didn't go into Games Workshop and say, oh, I'm tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy that game. I thought you were running traveling. Now I bought this. Now that never happened. You couldn't afford it.
So we use it. Yeah, but we're using time as a regulator to kind of define that, aren't we? You're not buying Dragon Bane because you can afford it.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now there seems to be a lot more. There's plenty of really good games out there now, which probably wasn't back in the 80s. Well, there were other games, but probably weren't some of them. As we've experienced, they weren't all that good. And now you've also got the money to do it.
Yeah.
So time's the problem. But it wasn't, even though when we were younger, we had more time. Our mindfulness of games came naturally because you didn't have the money
to
buy different ones. So I spent a lot of time running Traveller. You spent a lot of time running RuneQuest because you couldn't afford any other games.
Yeah.
So that was that.
The way that it is in the moment, the week's divided up. We've got some regular slots. I think I'm playing one or two more than you at the moment. And that feels good, I think.
But feels good that you play more than me, which would be burn out.
I think what I'm trying to say is I'm enjoying what I'm playing. but it feels a bit disordered. And maybe it's just me being like a bit of a control freak, careers. I don't know what it is.
Well, it's become, I suppose the other thing is as well, since we came out of deep freeze, it's become something that we do as well.
Yes.
So there is that. There was a time when it was something we'd started doing again that felt very different. Whereas now it is something we do. Because you think, well, I do this. I take it granted almost that. I play role-playing games. And I play a lot of role-playing games. And I go here and I go there and I play online. And this is what I do. It possibly changes your view of it a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas 7 or 8 years ago, that wasn't the case.
I feel like I have to do a reset to try and find something new in the sessions I have. Not being very lofty about it, but just to push me a little bit. Sometimes think like, for example, you mentioned the Borealis connection that we're playing for Fall of Delta Green, which I am finding challenging as a games master to run because of the, I'm going to use another phrase I've learned from YouTube, because of the cognitive overhead. Cognitive overhead.
Okay.
Of trying to keep all the different elements in that game in my head so that it's working.
I think it's kind of interesting with Fall of Delta Green, because when you were running it the other night, I could see almost see your brain working. I know. Because there's an odd like continuum with these things. So, a long, long time ago, we talked about Numenera, and I got into Numenera in a big way. And I kind of fell out with it a bit, because Numenera is set in the future, millions of years in the future, and everything's weird in Numenera. So everyone lives in a mushroom or something weird, or they live in a glass palace. So everything's weird. And it's hard work to run it, because as a GM, you think, I've got to convey this weirdness, but God almighty, everything's weird. Oh, worries you out. And a bit further up, you got fantasy sci-fi, where standards fantasy sci-fi, everyone's got a common understanding of it.
It's a bit like Blade Runner.
It's a bit like Alien. It's a bit like Lord of the Rings. It's a bit like Elder Camelden. Oh, yeah. Well, that's easier to run than Numenera, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to run, because you don't have to, you can say, you walk into a tavern, you don't have to say, you walk into a tavern, but it's a giant obsidian apple shaped thing. Is it?
Where the outside is on the inside.
Yeah, the outside's on the inside, yeah.
And the inside's on the outside.
It's run by a talking mushroom, whatever. There's not that many mushrooms in it, but anyway, clutching at straws. Then you've got, and we've talked about this, then you've got stuff set in the real world. And that always feels like comfortable, because you think, set liminal, set in the real world, set in Manchester. That's great, isn't it? I remember Jonathan ran one in Manchester and he used the Salisbury, and you think, this is great, isn't it? Because everyone knows what these things look like.
Yes.
You've got to introduce a vampire or a werewolf or a ghost, but that's fine. But everyone knows.
And I'm playing Unknown Armies, which is set in contemporary history. So stuff that Boris Johnson's featuring in as the Crown Prince, for example. So I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Because it was...
Could you relate to it? But then, and I think it's what we discovered with Fall of Delta Green, there's another notch up on that. Whereas we're in Saigon, aren't we? In 1968.
In February.
February 1968. And it just
after the Tet Offensive in Saigon.
Yeah. You don't even know what it means. But it's so real. It's like real as in real. So there's all this history going on and all this detail in it where you think, that's as weird as Numenera. It's as much hard work as Numenera. It's as much hard work to say you walk into a tavern, which is an obsidian apple where the outside's on the inside and it's run by mushroom people. It's just as hard to say you're in Saigon in February 1968, just after Tet Offensive. Because there was a point where we meet this general. And I said, well, we said, oh, let's go and talk to this general in the American army. And you said, oh, he's got a house over in this quarter of the city. And I said, what? I said suspiciously.
Yeah.
Because you don't trust anyone. I suspiciously said, would a general live in Saigon in a house, or would he just be in barracks? I mean, what went on in 68 in Saigon? Did American generals have their own houses? And you really looked like terrified and went, as if like to say, you didn't say it, but you just went, I don't know. Actually, no. Hang on a minute. There's about 10 pages of background. Just let me check and see if it's in here. Yeah. And apparently,
They did.
It seems like they did. He's all right. No, spoiler there. He's all right. Seems to be.
It was played by Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman, yeah. But there is that. That is the problem, isn't it? That there's a... It's setting it in the real world, but it's kind of vaguely the real world, just in terms of set dressing. Then setting something that's in the real world, as in all the historical data's there. So
you
as a GM could say, well, it's Saigon, 1968, and of course this happens or that happens, and someone could say, well, I don't think that would never have happened. Would never have happened in February 68, maybe July by the time the events had died down, but not in February.
The other level is you've got the level of the track of history, which is important to it. You've got your Veilite mission, so the kind of official mission that's been on the books mission that you have to fulfill. And I've got to remember everything that you need to do for that, as well as present it to you.
Yeah.
Then you've got your Delta Green mission. That's about a mission that had happened in the last decade, so in 55. So you're in 68, looking back on something. So there's so many layers of detail.
Yeah.
You kind of wish that it came with like a module that you can plug into your head.
Plug into neural interface.
Of Ken Haidt.
You know, all the information.
I want to have Ken Haidt's brain for the week.
Ken Haidt saying that, saying it's you.
Yeah.
Don't say anything, Ken. That'd be quite difficult for Paul's fame. Don't say anything, Ken, until we need you to. So when Blythe says, did generals live in houses in Saigon? You can go, I don't know. Ken.
Ken.
Can I bring you in here, Ken?
Ken.
What's the score with that? Did they? And then Ken could explain it.
Give us a 10-minute thing about the decadence.
Talk about it. Yeah. You go, oh, I see. Hey, good. Right, quiet now, Ken. Carry on.
Yeah.
That's what we need. Ken Haidt subtitles, okay. Some kind of commentary. Ken Haidt commentary on
it. Let's put that on Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. Ken will join your game.
But I'm really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying running it. But what I'm saying that it's pushing me because normally I do a ratio of saying, right, for prep for a game, if it's a 2-hour game, I really shouldn't be spending any more than 2 hours.
Yeah.
Because that's what I say at work. If you're doing a presentation, really, it should be a ratio equivalent.
Yeah.
So if you're doing a 2-hour presentation, you really should spend a good couple of hours preparing for
the same amount of time.
Same, but that, people, it's just my way of, as a toxic productivity guru, that that's how I apportion time to preparation. But it's taking longer because there's so much depth to it.
Yeah.
It's just like the layers and complexity of the bureaucracy of the American military. Now, some people might know that because it might be part of their general knowledge.
Yeah.
It isn't part of mine.
No. And this sounds like really a criticism because in some ways it's brilliant. It's brilliant, but it feels that kind of reality to it. But there is that thing of, I say it's like a continuum, but it's almost like a circle where Numenera and Fall Down Green are almost touching. They're almost touching because you know how much difference between Mushroom Tavern and Saigon in 1968 from the perspective of running it, playing in it and thinking there's all this real stuff going on
and that you need making to sure that authentic things happen and that it's not anachronistic.
And I suppose it's where, that's kind of where it differs from a game like Vasen, for example.
Yeah.
Well, Vasen, set in Victorian Sweden, Victorian world, but it has some quite specific paragraphs in that say, it's your Victorian world.
Yeah.
I think it uses the example of revolvers or typewriters. If you're setting it in the mid-1800s or whenever, before the typewriter was invented, but you want a typewriter in it, just put a typewriter in it.
Yeah.
It's not a history lesson. It's simple as that. Whereas The Fall of Delta Green feels like, I won't say it feels like a history lesson, but it feels like it's important.
Yes.
I suppose with Vasen, it's not important.
I don't think that I would be giving you a fallen Delta Green experience.
Yes.
If I shrimped.
I'm not arguing that you should skirt over those things. I think they're integral to.
Yeah.
Whereas in a game like Vasen, it's not integral.
Yeah.
Because the game is not really about history, but Fallen Delta Green it is in part about history, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a game that involves you connecting and interacting with the historical setting.
Yeah.
And because it's a modern historical setting, I suppose this is a factor, because it's a modern historical setting,
it is, by its very nature, more complicated. If it was set in ancient Rome, there'd be loads of scope for bluffing, all sorts of stuff, wouldn't there? Because there's a lot known about the ancient Romans. Probably less known about them compared to Saigon in 1968.
So could you ever see yourself in that position where you set yourself a personal challenge in your gaming? Or are you just happy to take it as it comes?
A personal challenge in what sense?
Well, just that thing where, I started off saying, I set myself a challenge this year to watch the best sight and sound movies from last year.
I started doing it well. Because every Christmas when I'm a bit bored, I look at my games and I think, right, next year, what am I going to run? What do I want to run? And I do a little, I always stick to it, things fall by the way. I do a little list of things where I think, I want to run that and I want to run this to try and...
Well, either, who knew?
Try and rein myself
in. Who knew that you would be a mindful gamer?
A mindful, toxic guru, whatever. I'm a toxic, not a toxic guru.
Toxic productivity guru.
Toxic productivity, not a toxic guru. These are different things.
That's a different thing.
That'd be a different thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying to stick to it, but I do kind of think.
Set a resolution.
Sort of, yeah, because I look at all the games I've got. I think what you've been discussing is what goes through my mind, where I think I've got all this stuff. What am I going to do? What am I going to run?
Cheers, Blythe. Let's get back to our pint.
Goodbye. All right. This Cowie Norland vexes gaming wretches or whatever it is.
Thanks for the intro, Dave. I'm Steve, host of All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes, a podcast documenting my ongoing mission to run or at least play all of the RPGs that I seem to be incapable of stopping myself buying.
And you'll see me frequently fiddling with something in my hands.
Each episode, I get together with a group of fellow gamers that have either played a game I've run or who've GM'd a game for me. We chat through what we've enjoyed about the game and some ways we could have improved the experience, whilst making a series of terrible jokes along the way.
Was it hot chat action?
Sometimes we con game designers who really should know better to come along and talk to us about their games, and maybe run an actual play segment to give us an idea of their vision for their game.
I've told this story before, I won't bore anyone.
Our topics range from old school favourites like RuneQuest through to some of those newfangled narrative games all the cool kids talk about. When you listen, I want you to feel as though you're sitting around our gaming table, taking part in our post-game chat and helping dispose of the last of the crisps and ale.
I'll just wax my bowstring and think about the death of the tainted.
Oh no, 898.
So, if you like listening to people droning on excitedly about games in a range of regional British accents, All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes is the pod for you, and you'll find it on your podcasting app of choice. On occasion, you may even hear something really insightful, but I'm making no promises. Over to you, Dave.
Point to Ponxes and make it a Titan.
Keep it high.
I'll get me cooked.
Well, we're wearing our coats, we're heading towards the door. But it's a bit of an illusion because, thanks to the magic of a pause button, we've actually come forward in time from when we were last speaking, because we're not in the Latagarinade. We're up in the attic with the pigeon with the white eye tapping at the window. It's looking pleased. It's sunbathing here in Bolton because the sun is in the sky and we've just returned from Expo. What did you make of it, Blythe?
I enjoyed it. I'd say it's the best Expo I've been to.
Against what criteria?
It's criteria that there was no really crap bit. I think every Expo I've been to has always been something. It's probably been documented in these podcasts of something that's happened that I've thought, oh God almighty, this has put a shadow, cast a shadow over it. Ranging from, the time when there was no table for me, the time when I got involved in a really bad game that I really disliked, couldn't cope with, ranging from the time when somebody's brother-in-law died halfway through my game that I was running, which was a terrible kind of, that put a bit of a damper on things. I mean, he wasn't at the table,
Yeah.
But so there's always been something at Expo that's taken the edge off it a bit. The transport was better this time. We were lucky, weren't we? And I think you're right in saying that the organisation was a marked improvement. Getting tickets was a lot easier.
Yeah.
Somehow the layout of the hall with the trade hall was easier to navigate and find yourself around.
And also some of our games, the game I ran and one of the games I played was in a different room in the actual NEC, which was a better room
than some of the ones in the Hilton.
It's called the Tout Suite. Ticket Touts. Is it named after Ticket Touts? In honour of Ticket Touts at the NEC. But that's quite a good room. It's quite a bit more spacious and the sound's better in it. And I had two games in that. I played Julian's Exocor Classic game and I ran Year Zero in that room. And I have to say, that room was a lot better than some of the hotel rooms, the hotel kind of suites that can be a bit cramped, a bit noisy.
Yeah.
So that helped.
So for this, it's very close after the event. So for this closing time chatter, I'm going to limit ourselves to one highlight.
Okay.
And we'll perhaps revisit some of our experiences in later podcasts. But what were your highlights for you?
Well, one highlight was running Mutant Year Zero.
Oh, yeah.
Actually running it.
It was touch and go, wasn't it?
It was touch and go because I didn't have any players. And so it got to the week before and I had one player. And I emailed the expo organisers and I said...
Am I allowed to say, Blythe, that your ego was somewhat bruised by
it? Was a bit because I thought, oh, right, no one wants to play it. Oh, that's a bit of a blow. I think your ego is a bit bruised when that happens, isn't it?
I don't think
it's just me. I think anyone is. And I suppose it's slightly unusual, actually, because I've run games at Expo before and they always fill up pretty quick, don't they?
Yeah.
In fact, I think it's kind of noteworthy, this. At first, I thought, it was just me. But when I looked, a lot of games hadn't quite filled.
Yes.
And when I was there playing on the Friday afternoon, I noticed a couple of tables only had a couple of players. You know, I saw that quite a bit. As if they hadn't sold quite as many tickets for the role-playing games as they had in previous years. So I didn't take it... When I worked that out, I'd take it quite too personally, I suppose. But yeah, it's a bit... puts you in a funny position because you've got one player. And I emailed them and I said, look, I've got one player. I'm not sure I can run it for one player. I can run it for two, but I can't run it for one. So what do I do? I was thinking, I'll just pull the game. They came back with an incredibly, annoyingly reasonable answer where they said, oh, don't worry. These things can fill up at the last minute. And if you don't get any more players, we'll find a game for you and your other player. Oh.
You can't argue with that.
You can't argue with that. Oh, Expo, stop being so reasonable. I'll have to take all my stuff and I might not run it.
Yeah.
But in the end, I did run it because on the Saturday night when we were in the bar, the tickets all sold. It was really strange when I was thinking, I've sold all my tickets. So I had a full house and I ran it. And so it felt like a highlight because all the way through it, I thought, I'm not going to be running this game. And then in the end, I did.
I should say that mine filled up fairly quickly, I'm glad to say.
Of course.
Almost immediately.
Celebrity GM. I'm sidekick GM, you're celebrity. That's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, there is a certain irony that on the morning, I sat waiting, only two players turned up.
Yeah, there was a certain irony. You text me, you're another part of the hotel. You text me and said, I've only got two players, I've got four. Okay.
Yeah,
but it was a highlight because I really enjoyed running Mutant Year Zero, and I think it doesn't get as much love really as it should because it's the first Free League game, isn't it, that they produced? And these days, everyone bangs on about Free League games, and I sometimes think Mutant Year Zero is forgotten a bit. But it's a great game, and I really enjoyed it. You know, it was one of the Grog squad. Paul was there, and three younger people.
Younger people,
and they enjoyed it. I'm not putting this down to me being a great GM. That's for others to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's for others to say. I'm not saying that because I don't think I am. But I think the game itself is a good game, and the people who never played it before went away saying, "I really enjoyed that game as a system. It's a really good, an interesting system that can carry a lot of things." So there wasn't much fighting in it. There were lots of challenges that could have ended up in combat, but they kind of avoided the fights. And you know, we'd played for maybe 4 hours and there was only one fight, and yet it felt like there was jeopardy. The game system makes things like negotiating or coming up with other plans to avoid fights just as interesting as fights. And that's quite a testament to it as a system, really.
Yeah.
You know, not many systems can do that.
And you distribute the mutations at the table, don't you?
I do, yeah. It's funny, I have the cards of the mutations, and I have the cards for the artifacts. So in the scenario, we find artifacts. It's no different from rolling on a table, because the tables are in the rule, but you can roll for the artifacts, you can roll for the mutations. But it's surprising how people do like a pack of cards, don't they? There's a certain delight. People take a certain delight in going, you found an artifact. Oh, right, take one from the pack. Oh, what am I going to get? You can roll the dice. It's the same thing. But
yeah, it's a physicality of it.
But I suppose that was my highlight, because in a way, it wasn't the only highlight. I did have some very good games. In fact, every game played was good. Again, a first at Expo. Every game I played was good.
Yeah.
Can't really fault any of the games I played. That was good. But I suppose it was a highlight, because up until about 10 p.m. on the Saturday night, yeah, I didn't think I was running it. And then I was.
My experience was similar to yours a couple of years ago when you said only had two players, but somehow it worked out a lot better than you expected.
You can't run it with two people. You can. I think this is the odd thing. I'm not sure you can run it with one person, but you can run it with two people. And
we did it for years, didn't we, Blythe? We only me, you, and Eddie playing them.
Yeah,
so we're good at it.
To us, doesn't really seem that weird. It doesn't. That's true. It doesn't seem that strange, does it? Yeah.
I was doing the Wages of Fear, which is the Day After Ragnarok scenario for Savage Worlds. And I'd run it a couple of times, and it did kind of work better with two players because it is just a string of encounters, really, because it's a road trip with this highly volatile awfully that is likely to explode at any time. Just traveling through the road, and what was good, the players were good. They engaged with each other, and it ended up being like a bit of a buddy movie, because the players played off each other, and there were some nice moments. But also, I was able to get through more of the encounters than I would normally with five players. And so it felt more of a road trip, so it felt more significant. But when they got to the end, like 3.5 hours, they'd encountered a lot. They'd done a lot of things on the journey, and the fact that and a tanker was still intact was more significant somehow. So, yeah, that was fun.
I think sometimes at conventions, and I understand why people do it, because people drop out. So obviously you need to over-egg the number of players. But I think five or six players at a convention can be too many.
Yeah.
Three or four is a good number at a convention, particularly if people have never played the system before.
Yes.
Because it's quite difficult if you get full six players who've never played that game. You're kind of managing their understanding of the game, but it's six people. Whereas if it's two or three or four people, it's much easier to manage. If they've never played it before, it's easy to manage that, I think, the conventions. I understand why they do six players, because people drop out.
I had some good games at Expo.
Yeah,
and enjoyed them, and perhaps we'll talk about those at another time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention that we did partake in a fringe event.
Fringe it was.
Offsite. Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the Grog Squad had hired. Well, how would you describe it by then?
Well, it would describe it as a Young Offenders Institute, an Old Offenders Institute, because it was like they started calling it a Barstool. It was like a Barstool.
Yeah, it was like a outward bound adventure centre.
Yes.
That was built sometime in the 70s.
Yeah, on the side of the canal, wasn't it?
I think it was locked in some kind of time loop.
Yeah.
Because there was a point of convergence of the Ring Road railway track.
It's like a liminal, wasn't it?
Yeah, and a canal.
Yeah.
All coming together in this building.
And the Uber driver couldn't find it.
Well, he could find it, but it was on the side of Ring Road, and he refused to leave us there.
He said there's nothing there.
He said there's
nothing. It was like something liminal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He said there's nothing there.
There's nothing there.
Oh, there is. Oh, there's nothing.
I'm not leaving you on the Ring Road here.
Like some ghost building. I'm not leaving you. He's very... credit to that Uber driver.
Yeah.
He's very diligent, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
He's very diligent. I'm not leaving you on the side of the Ring Road.
three old fellas, me, you and Jonathan, three old fellas. We thought, it's confused old fellas. Can't leave them at the side of the ring.
They've clearly escaped from something.
I can't leave them. Yeah.
Anyway, we were beckoned in and there was lots of hospitality.
It was.
And there were games being played.
Yes.
And we played a couple of games there. But I wanted to give a special mention to Ghostbusters, which I've never played before. And that's the West End Games.
Yeah.
Game. There's a precursor to Star Wars. It uses a similar D6 mechanic.
Yeah. D6 pool, isn't it? Add them all up. Yeah.
Yeah. And reach a target number. It was really good.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
I think because the context of it, it is comedy. And I think Mike presented it in a good way, that there were some jokes built into the scenario.
Yes, there were some jokey bits, jokey set pieces that were built in, which were very good, yeah.
Yeah. And, as players, you had license. It didn't try too hard, though, to be comic.
No.
Which is always a danger, isn't it?
It's quite light. I think the thing is, it's quite light touch in the comedy. And it's also got some good elements that make you think about the game as well. So it's not just a load of slapstick laughs. So I quite like the idea with the cards, the equipment cards.
Yes.
Where it said you can only carry three equipment cards.
Yeah.
Like encumbrance made simple. Well, that's quite a good bit of the game because there's lots of useful equipment. You start thinking, well, what do we want to take into this place to fight these? We need a ghost trap. We can't all carry a ghost. We need a backpack. So you need this, you need that. That was quite interesting. But I suppose what that did was, although it's a comedy game, it had elements that made you think, not in a necessarily comic way. You did have to actually think about, oh, hang on, what do we want to carry?
Yeah.
Because encumbrance is one of those things in games that's always a bit boring, but it's quite ahead of its time, really, where it said you got three, you've got all these cards on the table, haven't you, with all this stuff. Some of it apparently useless, although it wasn't useless, like scuba diving stuff. In the end, that wasn't useless.
And alpine climbing equipment.
Alpine climbing equipment, yeah. All that stuff. And you can only carry three things. So you got, maybe I'll take this, maybe I'll take that. That's quite a clever thing, really, in the game. Yeah.
During most of the game, cool, because we min-maxed the attributes, didn't we, to make sure we had a good distribution. Mine was a cool character, ran a vegan restaurant. No, a vegetarian restaurant. We're having a fight with the vegans, weren't we?
Yeah, we were. It was a vegetarian sandwich shop, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Roastbusters.
Not Roastbusters. Yeah.
Not Roastbusters.
And he spent most of the second half of the scenario in Lederbosen for reasons best known.
Best known to himself.
Yeah.
But it's a good game. Very, very, like I say, ahead of its time in many ways. So that the encumbrance thing with the cards, nowadays you wouldn't think much of that. But back then, that's quite an innovative thing, wasn't it? And it's like the ghost dice, isn't it? You've got one of your D6s is a ghost dice. And if a one comes up as the ghost symbol, even if you succeed, something goes wrong.
There's a complication.
Think back to when that game was released. That concept is very much ahead of its time, isn't it?
And there's not a lot to it, but it's really flavoursome. The idea is brownie points that you can expend to increase your pool, and you can increase them by engaging with your character goals. I thought that was good. But I think the other thing to mention is Mike went to great efforts in producing handouts, floor plans, and we had figures.
Yeah.
And I think that contributed such a great deal to the success of the game.
Yeah.
Because it had a wow factor.
Yeah, we can't give too much away in case people play it. But there were certain wow factors with some of the paraphernalia. He upped the game's paraphernalia considerably, didn't he?
Yeah.
You'd struggle to beat some of that paraphernalia. Oh, it's almost there.
I always have the view, as you know, I may have expounded this theory in the past, that it requires a lot of effort to do, though, just that level of bling and that level of preparation. And I'm not always sure that it absolutely contributes to the success of the game.
Yeah.
It gives, the results are marginal, but I think it was different in that case. Mm-hmm. The analogy I use is, they say, don't they, that if you're traveling at 60 miles an hour, it's 1 mile a minute, you're probably traveling at an appropriate speed to get to your destination safely. As soon as you start going above 60 miles an hour, the risks are increased and the amount of stress is increased, but the results are marginal.
Yeah.
And I feel the same thing about bling in role-playing games is that if you're traveling at 60 miles an hour, you're going to have a good game. Why put yourself through all that extra effort and stress? And for what? A fee marginal? But I think in this case, it was significant to the experience of it.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it did have a certain something to it. Yeah. I always think with stuff like that, though, I'm not very good at that kind of stuff. I'm not very good at all the crafty stuff you need to be good at to make stuff. I can't do it, so just better not if I don't do it, because I would look a bit half-baked if I did it. So I just don't do it.
Yeah. I like to do it when I can, but in the knowledge that it's going to just increase the amount of effort that is required for it.
Yeah.
And the volume of games that we run doesn't always allow for that level of investment of time, really.
Yeah, and it's a strange thing, isn't it? I mean, my experience at Expo was, we're going to talk about these things in more detail, you know, because I played some other good games. I played Tales of the Old West, which was really, really good, and I played two games of X-Crawl Classics. But what was very interesting was I played X-Crawl Classics run by Brendan LaSalle, the designer from Goodman Games. And I went to that game thinking, well, I wonder if he'll have loads of bling here because it's Goodman Games. Will he have loads of miniatures? Did he have any of that? He drew the map on a piece of A4 paper for us.
That's all you need.
Do you know what? He's a fantastic games master. He's a really good games master, energetic, really creative, great games master. The fact he did that was neither here nor there. No one cared.
Yeah.
No one cared that he was drawing it on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
It worked. It did work. It worked. Completely worked. And it's fine. It's strangely reassuring because that's the kind of thing I do. Oh, it's all right then.
Yeah.
Can't be that bad.
Yeah. But occasionally it does make things memorable. And I think in the case of Ghostbusters, it definitely did.
And I think, maybe it's the game. Maybe it's the game, I think. I don't know whether it is because it's Ghostbusters somehow.
Yeah.
Because
it set the tone, I think.
Yeah.
Set the tone, which was a sort of Ghostbusters from the 80s meets The Boys, because it had sudden outbursts of violence, didn't it?
Or violence we would never encounter in a Ghostbusters film. We can't go into detail because of spoilers, but suffice to say Ian McShane came to a sticky end.
One final thing I wanted to mention over the weekend, because I'm still sort of astonished by it but also a bit afraid. And I'm going to mention AI now. People listening,
don't switch off.
Don't switch off. I can hear your hackles rising. I can hear you bristling, even from here. But yeah, we saw a demonstration of AI, which kind of left us a bit
creepy, rather chilling. Yeah.
So John, who was playing in the Ghostbusters game, thought he would try and find out how the game worked, what the rules were. So he asked an AI tool to create a podcast for him explaining the rules and the origins of the game, which it did. And we listened to it, didn't it? And it was two American voices. There weren't robot voices, there were people's voices.
I would have, if you'd have played that to me and not told me it was AI, I would have thought it was real.
So it is a man and woman in dialogue with each other. They were umming and ahhing. They kept referring to everything as iconic. So that's what happens in all podcasts.
That's what happens in everything these days. Everyone's iconic. Well, you got to always watch the one show. Every guest they have on's iconic. You know what iconic means? Do you know what it means, don't you? Does it mean you've been in EastEnders for 10 years? Does it mean that, anyway?
So you get it was like a dialogue, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly funny, was it? So
it wasn't funny. I think he did say that if we listened to a few minutes of it, he did say if you listened to the whole thing, there are little clues that it might not be real, because there's certain little telltale signs that the way the dialogue is a bit odd. But to be fair, would you listen to it that closely? And would you even consider that if you weren't told it was AI? You know.
And the other thing that you can do, of course,
is get samples of voices, and then you can make that podcast to be our voices.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. How do people know?
Oh, this isn't really.
Yeah, this.
Aha.
Yeah.
We've not used the word iconic enough.
No.
That's the telltale. Once we start, if you listen to a podcast and we start using the word iconic every other sentence, you'll know it's AI, it's not real.
Yeah, that's our safe word.
That's the safe word.
Fish fingers and iconic.
Iconic fish fingers. Once you hear that,
yeah.
Well, you just have. But if you hear it again, you'll know it's AI.
All right. Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye.
There isn't another bit.
Lots of thanks to Adrian for his introduction to Ars Magica and contributing to my understanding of the game. I want to give a quick mention to some recent appearances on other podcasts. I know. I was on All Length Rex's Gaming Vexes talking about GM tools and transferable mechanics. And I managed to catch up with Gaz from the Smart Party podcast. We haven't spoken to each other for a while, so it was good to talk about out with the old and in with the new. And Gaz invited me on to mark the 10th anniversary of the Grog Pod and ask how things have changed. Keen-eared listeners will notice a bit of a switcheroo about halfway where the interviewer turns interviewee. But it was a chat, so that's okay, isn't it? I'll put a link to both shows in the show notes. Next month, we will have been podcasting for 10 years. I know, I can't believe it either. We set out to write a memoir about our role-playing years, found the writing process a bit too difficult to fit in with our lives, and went for a podcast instead. Hey, Blythe, we might find some people to play with. By accident, we created a wonderful community of players rediscovering the long-lost RPGs from the loft. It's been a great ride so far, so thanks for being with us as we go. I know I say this every time, and I know that most people have stopped listening by this point, but for the podcast to keep going, it needs listeners to be engaged, and we really appreciate the reviews, passing it on to one of your friends who might be interested in listening to it, and letting us know your thoughts. So thank you for your role in doing that. It's appreciated. Thanks too to all the people who throw coins in the beret every month. This thing of ours wouldn't have lasted so long without you. Those tips give us encouragement to continue what we're doing on the podcast, but also covers everything else, such as the Discord and events and other side projects. We have recently given the patron a bit of a refresh, and we can now offer an annual contribution at a discount. See patron for details. Also, most of the ideas for this podcast have been stolen from the wonderful Word in Your Ear podcast from the indefatigable David Hepworth and Mark Allen. We borrowed one of their ideas for a benefit for supporting us at the top tier. If you choose the contour rug level of support, you know, one of those neat little rugs that you put round an armchair or a toilet even, we'll come and chat to you over Zoom for your birthday. Maybe we'll chat about your first lasting everything or something you've recently purchased. Again, see Patreon for details. We've had some new people join the Honorary Armchair Adventurers through Patreon. At the Fancy Poof level, we have Mark Waterhouse, Tony Kemp, Matt Duffin, Andrew Gregg, Gua, and Billy Bridgepole. Thank you. Above the So Far So Good level, I'd like to give a virtual gift rolled from a table, apparently at random, and this time I'm heading for Ars Magica, the Art of Magic, and giving the supporters some spells for their personal use at home. Bibliopunk gets the transformation of the thorny staff. Thank you. Chris Went gets the shriek of impending shafts. Michael Berneth gets sense the nature of this. Joe-Yon Finch can mask the odour of magic. and Ian McManus, The Demon's Eternal Oblivion, which is fitting as Ian was Beelzebub, who ran the PBM Gladiators Gazette back in the 80s, which I've spoken about at length. Bringing that back in some form would be a good Patreon project. I'll put it on the someday maybe list. And at the high back chair level, we have Adam Rosser, and he gets the Cloak of Duck Feathers. And the highest tier is Contour Rug, and Shane McGovern gets the Stench of 20 Corpses. And we'll be round to yours on your birthday. Put the kettle on. And maybe don't cast that spell while we're there. If I've messed up your name or you've recently supported us and I haven't given you a mention, please let me know. The app has changed the settings and it's now easy to miss some of the notifications. If it's been a while since you've had a mention, let me know and I'll give you another shout out of thanks. Right, that's that. I need to attend some important matters. Let me just fast forward this to the auction at the end. Adios, amigos.